if you are starting a company, really, really be cognizant of who you're starting with, that you're really going into the trenches with someone.
Unconventional Life, the show where I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creators, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Twice a week, we will explore how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck. I'm your host, Joel Schroeder.
Unconventional Life Show, welcome. This is your host, Joel Schroeder. I have got John Fisher tuning in today. John, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
I'm ready. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So John is the co-inventor and founding CEO of CrowdOptic, known for its augmented reality technology and triangulation algorithms. So CrowdOptic gathers and analyzes data from smart devices based on where they are pointed to identify areas of interest. So for any of those that love augmented reality, all kinds of tech stuff, you're going to really enjoy this episode. They actually just did their 25,000th live stream, which is pretty awesome. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I know, John, you're also an author, a professor at UC Berkeley, and you were named by American City Business Journal's 40 Under 40 in 2006. So not to date you too much on our show about millennials, but we're super excited to have you on the show. Fill in any gaps that I might have left out and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
Thank you. Well, just lecturing at Berkeley, a prof over at USF, but it's all in the Bay Area and great students across the board. For me, I guess for your viewers and listeners to kick off, we sold our last company to Oracle. And when you go through that, it's a pretty incredible psychological experience. And so I was always into the ocean, but I got really into racing, boats and everything else, because, of course, Larry Ellison and all his lieutenants are so into that. So it's literally in the water. With that type of organization. And that's actually where CrowdOptic was born. I was looking at the boats race across the ocean one day, and I was trying to figure out how to get more information about them. And it turns out that you needed a form of triangulation to teach a device to be able to reconcile one of these boats. So an idea was born that was pretty awesome. And it's that's kind of the most romantic part of inventorship and entrepreneurship for me. I've worked with the same engineering team for the better part of 20 years. And so we're used to the, the Starbucks sessions. We go and we horse it out. And they were really excited about this. We're kind of, as I'm sure you have witnessed, a less good looking version of the Ocean's 11 team, right? and we we look for each opportunity. We do it legally. But we look for each opportunity to go in and we do it with our whole hearts, and we don't sue each other. We don't, step on each other's necks. We're all in it like almost a second family. And it's a great way to do business.
Yeah, I love that. So, I think when some people listening, they hear about being an inventor and what it's like to basically just iterate and create things. I mean, like popular, inventors like Albert Einstein, we can go way back, for example. But what does being a modern day inventor to you look like? Because I know in your career, your life cycle, CrowdOptic is the current iteration. But like you said, 20 years, you've been trusting all these different things. So give us a glimpse of that.
It's, if you're just starting out, it's the greatest thing in the world. I mean, of course, I would love to be able to play guitar or to be a professional athlete. And I've worked with people who do that and they say it's incredible. But this is the thing that I was at least able to do. And it is, you can walk into any room, you can deal with any group of people and just have the most fantastic discussions about your pursuits and, how you came up with this and how you're working with it. And I think it's just a fantastic profession, and money is important and there's a lot of it there if you can execute on an idea. But I think you mentioned Einstein, maybe Edison was one of the best, right? And he actually coined a phrase that I'm very unhappy with. He talked to the notion, paraphrasing, of 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. That's paraphrasing. That's no good. I think the 1%, I think the inspiration is so critical. And I think it's such a big part of it. And it's how, people in my chair versus a co-founding, CTO or a CFO, I mean, we're supposed to, the guys that found the company and run the company, we're supposed to inspire. And there's nothing more inspiring than how you came up with an idea and why, and the how and the problems you're solving. So execution is important, but let's never forget that the notion of coming up with an idea is an incredibly important thing. And I tell that to my, 7-year-old little girl when she's coming up with an idea, and or my wife's coming up with ideas, and the whole society will say, well, what does that mean? Or what is that going to become? And just the notion of coming up with an idea should be cherished above all else.
Yeah. So I love that. And I love that you're highlighting that, because I know a lot of our listeners, sometimes they're like, John, I have so many ideas. And how do I take this idea flow? Like, what's the process from having these things come to your mind, actually filtering and knowing what's worth pursuing and what's worth choosing? And, how would you describe that in your own life?
Yeah. So that's where the execution piece comes in. I'm not, the biggest fan of that. It's so necessary to build a company and to to see an idea to fruition. But that's kind of what I meant by society and its pressures. We're operationalizing everything we're doing. A great idea is a great idea, and that should be cherished. And then how you implement it is often iterative, often much less romantic is a word I use, or much less special than the notion of coming up with something that's inspirational. But how I do it is I listen to clients, I listen to fellow engineers, I listen to a market. Timing is so important in these things, and we just all have to reconcile ourselves with that. Some people get very lucky in addition to all the other mandatory things that go along with that. And some people are on the wrong side of the curve and did everything right, but they get smashed by, terrible market conditions. So it's a highly iterative process once you have an idea. And I think paying attention, especially to what I call strategic customers, is so important. Customers that are large enough, discerning enough technologically, and can pay you enough to help you iterate, not just the notion of a product, but your entire company.
Yeah, I love that. And for those listening, I know you've got something exciting with HP that we'll talk about a little bit later and more into the strategy side of those customers. But if we were to turn back time a bit and come all the way back to, say, grade school, high school, growing up, if we were a fly on the wall in your younger years, would we have seen? Would we have seen this like quirky, nerdy guy that was the inventor type, or were you like the athletic jock, or what would your world have looked like at that point?
I was on a way to a catastrophe, I think is what my parents would say. I started my first business in the third grade, and my father helped me with that. It was an import-export business where I imported Ninja Stars weapons, and I sold them to my classmates, and one of my classmates ended up throwing one of these things. They throw through the air at a tree and narrowly missed a professor, and I was suspended from that school for a week. Now, I ended up serving 3 terms on the board of that school later in life, so they must have expunged that experience. But I wasn't a big fan of rules. I wasn't a big fan of discipline. And I really didn't know what I wanted to be doing and taking up my time until I was in my early 20s. And that's where I got really ambitious. And quickly, I went on a sailing trip for a lifetime. My best friend's father sold all his stock, interestingly, at Oracle. So that's when the fascination began. Did you ever see the movie where the guy is peering out at the trains running by his bedroom and gets obsessed with the trains and then has to marry the daughters of the train magnet? So that's what Oracle was like on my brain when I finally was introduced to that company. And I went on this sailing trip all around the world, from Bora Bora to Tahiti to Fanning Island and Hawaii and everything else. And that's where I really got ambitious, that you can do things like this with your time if you're entrepreneurial or if you embrace invention. And so I got very serious very quickly in my early 20s, and luckily it wasn't too late.
Would you like to take your business to the next level? This May, join us and 50 entrepreneurs in Petrituli, Italy for a 5-day business accelerator designed to uplevel every area of your life. We have rented out an entire town and castle. Get all of the details at unconventionallifeshow.com/Italy. And now back to the show.
Yeah, totally. So did you go to college and graduate college?
I did go to college. graduating college was another close call. So I went to a school called Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. This is in the Smith and Wesleyan Conference. And so I was a starter on the basketball team as a freshman, which was so fun. But then we lost to West Point by 52 points. And I said, this is not a good use of time. So I tried rowing and I tried this. You asked about the nerd versus the jock. So a little bit of everything. But then I started my first company in the dorm at Vassar, and I ended up leaving, coming back to the Valley. And the University of San Francisco was kind enough to give me a degree in less than a year by working at night, whereas a Berkeley, and all due respect, was going to take like 2.5 years and barely transfer any credit. So my parents are both Stanford PhDs. That stuff is very important. They didn't know, again, if I was going to be okay, so I promised them I'd finish school.
Nice. I love the role of parent figures and how the journey shapes out. And so
it's just a hedge. Yeah.
Totally. So I imagine there you are. You finally gotten this degree. You go on this sailing trip, have this like epiphany kind of moment, recognize this ambition. Let's talk about what happened after that, because I think a theme that I see with a lot of our guests is they're tracking in one way with life, whether they're living it on their terms or someone else's terms. Something happens. Sometimes it's something small, or sometimes it comes in the form of, you know, a sailing trip.
Yeah.
And then, you know, life kind of alters. And was that the case for you, where it was like, when you look back in your life, that was actually a really distinct turning point and things shifted? Or what's your relationship to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, God willing, no tragedy. The family and I, the extended family and I, have had, you know, a great experience. We're all a close family. We haven't had to go through what inevitably we all go through soon enough. So I'm hugely thankful for that. But I just got really ambitious really quickly. And I think that also comes from not being forced in a particular direction. Much more of a pressure cooker, I think, in other families where parents wanted their children to follow in their footsteps, et cetera, et cetera. So when I saw how the other half lives, is that fair? You know, my parents are teachers. And again, I wouldn't have traded that existence for anything. But when I saw what was possible, I really wanted that for myself. And I'm glad that I went after it.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people listening can relate to this ambitious quality where, you know, sometimes people write in and they're like, Jules, I've got so much drive and so much passion. I'm like exploding at the seams, but how do I channel it? And how do I actually direct it? And so what advice might you give them? And what steps did you begin to take once you saw, for example, I see how the other half lives, but then to actually be in, you know, concentrated action, how was that for you?
Yeah. So, you know, there's so many moving parts. You can start a company that you're setting up to grow, to be very large, or on the other side of the spectrum, it can be a nonprofit, anything in between, a lifestyle business. The first thing that I love to do is file provisional patent applications. It only costs $1,000, right? And then you can scream your idea to the rooftops without worrying. And if someone, you know, wants me to invest in their company, or someone's interested in starting a company and they go through this convoluted process of, well, will you sign an NDA, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, just protect your idea. And then you're out there. And I was the MC, I'll throw USF under the bus a little bit, of their business competition a few years ago. And, you know, it's 500 people in the audience and all these companies coming up, and there was no patent process, no patent protection. So every company that I introduced at that event, I was literally killing, because you, by articulating the idea, you forfeit international patent protection. And I told them that, and they helped change the process. But that's spooky stuff. The anti-patent winds that are blowing in this country, oh, the patent office is all screwed up and you need patents. Let me give you a really interesting thought, I think, for your listeners. I've done well. My wife thinks so. My investors think so. What I do is the Fortune 500 ends up acquiring my companies that we've built. And that's happened now 3 times. And CrowdOptic will be the 4th time. How do I get close enough to those companies to be acquired? Any of your listeners, viewers have been through that. It's a brutal process. Oracle is the toughest acquirer in the history of capitalism with Ellison and these guys. How do I get close enough to them so that they don't just figure out everything I do, put 100 of their own engineers on it, and just steal the whole thing? And I'm not saying that patents completely defend against that, but the notion of patents, the notion that, well, if you're going to play games with me, then maybe IBM or SAP will end up buying me, and then you'll have to deal with my patents across the street. That's part of how the game is played. And when I hear that, oh, patents are unnecessary and you don't need to play, that's fine if you're building a monstrosity. But we're now at all-time market highs, and I get the hairs on the back of the neck every economic cycle because I'm a little bit older than your typical viewer here and the reader here. It's coming again. There's going to be a big crash again, and all of it's going to fall out. And it's really important for us to recognize what is our defensible advantage. So the answer to your question is file a provisional patent, protect something that's important, and then get moving.
Yeah, that's such great advice. And I do. I think we don't get that perspective often because it's like the era of millennials and the digital age and it's free-flowing information and it's like patents that's so outdated. And yet what I'm hearing is like it's actually an integral step, especially for those really looking for the bigger buyouts, which I know is a lot of us. So.
And it's so incredibly cool too. Everyone starting something has got to be curious. I mean, we're coming up on our 10 millionth patent filed. 10 million in the history of, you know, of this country. That's not so many, right? And, you know, the first year there were 3 patents filed when the patent office started. And then you start ramping up and you get these greats. You know, the only U.S. president with an issued patent was Lincoln, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. So, you know, we need more patent holders in that office. We need more patent holders in Congress. But we need every entrepreneur and, by definition, inventor to be a patent holder.
Yeah, I love that. So as you mentioned, you know, you've done it 3 times, now working on the 4th time with CrowdOptic is getting, you know, your companies acquired by these Fortune 500 companies. I imagine there's a formula, at least now, you know, hindsight, looking back on how it's done for how you're starting to build the company and just some of the infrastructure that you're setting up with this ideal to eventually sell. Can you tell us a little bit about that from the lens of someone that either is actively running their company looking to do the same thing or someone looking to start a company with that specific outcome in mind?
Yeah, so here's a thought. You can invert the lens. These guys, the most acquisitive guys in the world, are buying a couple of companies a month. They're the ones that have to have a playbook. I mean, if you are a Fortune 500 company and you're buying 30 companies a year, you know systemically what you're doing. And so we should tap into that. We should have a knowledge as the guys looking to attract them of the things that interest them. One of the things I found to be most effective is, you know, really try to select the best clients. Winning Fortune 500 clients on our own is tough and it's brutal. And they'll walk you through all these exercises and then you'll come in second place and they'll say no. But if you're able to win them, clients that ultimately your highest propensity acquirers are interested in getting closer to, I think that's very sound strategy. You get paid along the way, you iterate along the way, you build quality and defensible stuff. And then your acquirer, by definition, wants you to scale through their, that synergy, through their acquisition to better serve these clients. So in my history, with AutoReach, we attracted AutoNation as a key entity. In NetClerk, we attracted Home Depot. In Barossa, we attracted Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is Oracle's 10th or 15th most important client. And in CrowdOptic, we have a number of Fortune 500 clients that that folks can read about. I can't pinpoint the exact client that will be staple to the acquisition because that hasn't happened yet, but it's the same formula. So strategic clients, strategic customers are so important as far as cozying up to them, learn from them, and then learn how your highest propensity acquirer, and you have to whiteboard this out, you know, what acquirers are most likely to take you out, want to get closer to those strategic clients.
Yeah, totally. So I think there's a gap for some of our listeners between the corporate world and the Fortune 500 as an entrepreneur, for example, of like, I can just do my own thing. I don't need corporations. I don't need that. Yet there's big payouts and there are a lot more opportunities with some of those larger companies. And so for those entrepreneurs that are hearing this, at what point do they need to be in order to start to attract some of these higher clients? And how would you recommend they start doing that? What are the things, their action steps they might need to take?
Well, back to the patent piece, do something that is really interesting and really defensible and try to solve problems. Go to environments and events where you can start talking to these Fortune 500 clients. What I want to do in some of these business schools is have these Fortune 500 guys show up and tell the students what to build. I mean, why go to business school? You know, just show up and say, well, this is what's on our R&D radar. We're not doing this right now, but we're thinking of doing this 3 years from now. So we're not going to put resources on it now, but go build this. And what's the worst that can happen with these students? They will get a strong sense of efficacy that they're participating in the world and do all the case study piece. And the best that could happen is they're actually told exactly how to succeed, right? Exactly what to build. And then they're being the right time at the right place. So I'm back to the defensible advantage, the patents, do something worth doing. I understand the temptation with Uber and PhotoShare and the rest. And again, all power to people that build very large companies. But I don't agree with the notion of being able to go public or raise hundreds of millions of dollars with no patents, with nothing that's defensible. And I think the days of that happening are going to come to an end. I think there are fewer and fewer venture capitalists that are able to fuel their portfolios based on these monstrosities. And perhaps after this crash, when we don't have houses to help prop us up, you'll see a fallout where we won't be able to build companies that large without doing something special. So that's the first thing, is I think build a company, build an idea that's worth doing. And then, as far as getting close to these guys, everyone has access. Everyone is looking for the next thing. As I said, my parents were teachers, but there was a board of directors at my high school or my college and friends of friends. And it's great being in the Valley, but there are many different epicenters and many different centers of innovation. So you can always email someone and protect your idea. and they can get back to you. Now, there's a difference, obviously, between starting a consumer and an enterprise play. So a lot of your folks may be starting consumer companies. And the comment there is, all power to you, that's fine. But just do something repeatable. You don't have to worry necessarily about profitability. You don't have to worry necessarily about cash flow. Keep yourself alive. But a business that is repeatable, that can be cookie cut and scaled over and over again, whether it's a consumer or an enterprise play, is ripe to then be taken out. Yeah. And that's basically my MO and my career in a nutshell. Build your company for strategic acquisition, because that's the 95% plus likely successful outcome, right? Don't plan for the monstrosity, because that's how most of us crash against the rocks. And if you do wildly exceed expectations and you're able to build something very big, great. But most of us try to build something great and something huge, and that's why we fail. And don't worry about being so myopic or this is what's wrong with Silicon Valley. This is also the best way to make a world contribution, because you sell to a great company and let them take your technology around the world. So Andreessen can say, he doesn't like the way we do this. We build smaller companies. But Netscape went to zero after 8 years. And my last company, now 10 years later, is still a standalone product for Oracle and used by hundreds of millions of people. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. It's awesome. So I, one of the reasons I want to have you on the show is you have this, more years of wisdom perspective, if you will, especially to us millennials. And to a lot of millennials that are listening, with all the different experiences that you've had, things you've seen. I mean, I imagine it's a little trippy in some senses to be professor at a, more traditional university. I'm not sure exactly what you teach or how you teach it, but then to also have all of this real world experience, there sometimes is this gap between what's being taught and actually what's being lived. And so through your experience, I'm curious if there's any piece of advice or common patterns or things that you're seeing amongst millennials or the students that you're teaching, and just stuff that maybe we could look out for or things that maybe we should know.
Don't get sued. There's always a way to work out things. I've never been in a lawsuit, and I got to always knock on wood when I say this publicly. In my technology career, how's that, 20 years? And you get, the president saying, well, it's okay because I've built all this and I've been in thousands of lawsuits. And then you get Mark Cuban saying, well, I'm better because I've been in 12 lawsuits. None. I mean, don't step on people's, necks is one thing I try to talk with the students about. And another thing is, you've got to put your family first. You can't sacrifice everything and think that you're going to come out the other end of this. The biggest gift that the first person who acquired my first company said is, he was very tough on his family and he said it wasn't worth it. And any quasi mentor I've had or anything else says that, putting your family first is so important. So that's another thing. And then, as far as doing this, try to find purpose. I find purpose in the invention. I love that stuff. But these things are so hard. Another thing I say to my students, if you want some practical analysis, is on the numbers. We talked about numbers before the show began. On the numbers, the average successful venture-backed company every quarter, every year, from the beginning of time to the end of time, is sold for about $30 million. 25, 35, 30. That's the data. So when you see these guys going out and raising a $25 million Series A, they're already betting for a home run. Don't get fired. Is what I say to these students. If you raise too much money, you're never going to be able to make those expectations unless you build the one out of a million company, and you're going to get fired. And they walk around saying, "What, you know, what happened?" And even when I say this, I get students that email me saying, "Oh, Sequoia just gave us, you know, 12 million Series A," and it's just that's beguiling. That's very sexy. But 2 years from now, I'm going to get a different kind of email almost all the time. So a basic understanding of venture finance, a basic understanding of the way these things most likely go. It's, you know, my mother is a clinical psychologist, but a big piece of that is statistics. Look at your statistics. Look at the way the world most often works. And all I'm saying is bake that into your strategy. That's not that hard.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk about where you see the world going. And I know you've dropped a few little hints to this throughout the interview so far, but the next few years at a glance, like, what should we be prepared for? What is the stuff that you feel like no one's talking about that should be talked about?
I get very nervous. I don't want to get off the reservation, but when you look at price earnings, you know, ratios, you know, Salesforce is a great company, but it trades at a PE of 300. And when I say great company, I mean, they're a large company now, right? A $50 billion some odd company. How long can that be supported versus Sanity is, you know, a 25 PE or whatever else. So it's happening again. And watching it happen, all I'm saying is I actually have calmed down a bit. I think you can start a company based on the inventor's premise at any time. Inspiration strikes, but if you start a company and you are trying to get your first round done or rally your clients and you're in the middle of a crash or right before, right after, it just makes it so much harder. So unfortunately, we're at unprecedented market highs, and everyone who's been in a previous market knows how this ends up. And I would ask that your folks just be cognizant of that. Again, just bake that into strategy that you may not want to raise more or less money, or you may not want to factor it in as much as I would like, but something wicked, something terrible this way is coming to the economy. So that's the one piece. And the other piece is, sold my last company in Q2 of 2007. That was pretty good timing, right? Q3 is when basically the whole financial crisis kicked in. Yeah. The world is different since the last financial crisis. So if you're listening or reading this and haven't been in business since then, it's different. As I said, I've never been involved in an action, yet I have to pay what I have to pay for directors and officers insurance and all the other insurance you pay. So everything is built in for, you know, calamity. And I would just suggest if you are starting a company, really, really be cognizant of who you're starting with. And, you know, if you have a long relationship together or your families get along, whatever else, but you're really going into the trenches with someone that you can't afford to fight with a year or two from now. So marry the right significant other, you know, you say anything you want, you know, partner with the right co-founder, all super important stuff. But I guess the chip on my shoulder I have is I've never built a billion-dollar company. Got to give power to and the props to people who have done that. But, you know, our last company returned 600%. That was invested in it in 3 years. Now, you can build a $1 billion company, but the investors who are coming in at a valuation of 800 million, or you're going public and it's below the last valuation, and you see how many IPOs are underwater, it's kind of cool where everyone makes money and everyone's happy. And it just so happens that it converges in a thesis that is build a smaller company. But again, build a smaller company, sell it to a great company, and you go around the world that way. Path of least resistance.
Yeah, so good. So I know you mentioned at the beginning that you've been working with the same team for about the last 20 years, which is phenomenal. And talk about co-founders, picking the right people. I know when I was like 23, ended up in 200 grand worth of debt because of a lousy co-founder, dealt with the whole inner workings of what that looks like, paying back clients at 30 grand a pop. It was quite a nightmare, but to say the least. So how have you been able to hold on and work with this team over the last 20 years? And for those that are looking to find that person, whether it's the co-founder, or maybe they're doing it solo and they're actually looking to build the team, what are some hacks or shortcuts or, you know, best practices that you've picked up along the way?
And this is, I think, a compliment to our president, I believe, but authenticity is so, I think, you know, important. I mean,
really good.
I think he's saying what he really thinks, you know, and leadership, I think that's such a key ingredient. They say that, you know, you need to sit in this chair and you need to be cool. You need to always project a sense of, you know, that we're going up and to the right on the graph and it's good. I don't lead that way. I really tell these guys what I think and what's going on. And forecasting to me, whether it be our numbers or the progression of the company, is about getting it as close to the mark as possible, not either exceeding expectations or under-realizing. I really try to tell people what I'm thinking so they can tell their families what I'm thinking, what we're thinking across the holiday table. We don't get together at Christmas parties, at Thanksgiving parties. We spend enough time together. So, you know, we're not going to do the whole cultural thing, but if they can get an authentic view of the business, I think that is an incredible gift to give to your team. The other piece is we actually don't really commute to offices. So I'm able to volunteer all kinds of hours at our daughter's school as our, you know, we all have young families. Again, we've grown up on this from our 20s to later. So we bake into this not the notion of you must be forced to do this in an office or anything else, but we all trust each other. So authenticity that begets, you know, the fact that why would you work this hard and be in this with us if you didn't mean it and we couldn't trust you. So another reason, I mean, I've built the company, 100 people, 50 people. This is the smallest company yet in terms of number of people, but it may be the most potent because, again, the algorithms can get baked into all these different systems. And you don't need people to do that. But these 15 people I'm working with, most of them I date back to almost 20 years. And that we wear that as a badge of honor. And by the way, it doesn't hurt with an acquisition because one of the biggest risks in a strategic acquisition is whether the folks are going to stick around, whether the asset is really going to scale and people are going to take it seriously. And while Oracle locked up all of my engineers for 2 years, I had engineers, many of them stayed for 4 and even 6 years. I mean, they loved the experience, not just of the cafeteria and taking it a little easier, I have to admit, but also seeing this stuff go around the world. So those are some, I think, really, I'm really thankful for some of the residual implications of working with a team like that.
Absolutely. No, it's awesome stuff. So I imagine, you know, with every great team, you also get conflict from time to time. And some of us tend to shy towards conflict. And I think, you know, at least in my own life, when I've mastered how to be with conflict in a way that is transparent and that is workable, things sometimes, you know, get even better out of going through it. And so what have you experienced with your own relationship to conflict and how do you kind of perceive that in the different companies you've started with these dynamic growing teams?
Yeah, one of the biggest problems I have, which I haven't found a great solution to, is I get accused by my team of making excuses from time to time. And I'm trying to be so big on not making excuses. I'm trying to explain what I think is happening. And it manifests as the, you know, this guy is saying that, you know, he's apologizing for this or this. The point is, when you're so formulaic the way we are, and then something goes completely wrong, we have institutionalized the notion of trying to explain this is exactly what happened. And sometimes in these things, conflict or otherwise, things go completely wrong and markets change or anything else, and there's nothing you can do about it. One thing Andreessen said, or paraphrasing, that I really believe in is a terrible market can defeat even the best team, the stock market, economic circumstance. So this stuff is when something goes really wrong and yet you're trying to be formulaic and you're trying to build the way we do, sometimes the team, even though we have all these years together, is very quick to pass judgment or to say that, you know, as I said, excuses are being made. And it's very difficult for me to put a structure on it, especially the older that we get. And the more time we have together, it gets worse and worse. Another area of conflict that I've had that's been painful is, as I said, I have most of these experiences with this team. But I have many other team members. As I said, I've worked with maybe close to 500 people in the Valley across all these different ventures. And sometimes you don't have room or sometimes it doesn't work out. But I also have a few people who I care about a lot who did not make as much money as they thought they were going to make. Now imagine that. We won, but they didn't make as much as they thought or certainly as much as I may have led them to believe. And I try to forecast, I try to explain this is your ownership, and I give people as much information as possible. But when you're let down like that, sometimes it's worse than failure, because failure at least is binary and you can process it. But this degree of why didn't I win more, or how much more did this guy win? So I'm working on that as well. And I haven't figured out a way to recapture some very talented, specifically some very talented engineers who feel that they didn't do as well as they should have.
Yeah. I appreciate your vulnerability and authenticity and just bringing that, because it's a human element of doing business and just of living in your life. And so I know a lot of our listeners probably appreciate hearing that as well. So yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit to CrowdOptic. I know you've got some exciting stuff coming up. I know I mentioned in the introduction the stuff with Hewlett-Packard, HP. Tell us a little bit about, I guess, first off, a little bit more about what CrowdOptic does, which is pretty cool with the algorithm side of things, and then we can talk a little bit about what's happening.
Yeah, CrowdOptic at its core is doing something fundamental. It's even a little haunting to us. So we have an algorithm that sits on devices. We're a live streaming company, but we do it on IoT and various hard-to-do wearable, hard-to-do devices. And through the live streaming, we have an algorithmic capability where via triangulation algorithms, we know where all the devices that are live streaming on the platform are aimed in common. So think about that for a minute. You have a couple of satellites that look down on your phone, for example, and the satellites know through triangulation the location of your phone. This is a company that through a couple of phones looking forward, you know how you hold up your phone to take a picture or video of something significant in the world, or you're at a sports event, whatever else. So phones are up all the time. If we live on those devices on our app platform, we know where they're aimed in common. We form a point in space, not the location of your device. We have that too, but everyone has that. We have the location of what you're looking at through your device and the object of interest. I think that's fundamental. I think that's fundamental to the flow of wearable. We're all going to have smart glasses years from now, the same way we all had smart telephones. Even I'm too young to really, I think, remember how mobile phones began. But to have that data object, something fundamental in the flow of something that's so big like wearable and IoT. So we have this algorithm, and we're able to talk to a partnership with Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, which is, you know, some of the greatest inventors in the history of the world, where we're combining our algorithm capability with their server infrastructure that's specifically designed their edge line servers to process, you know, out in the wild in crazy places like stadiums or sidewalks or police or fire and ambulance. So the notion of the live streaming and algorithmic piece we had for police officers, we are able to live stream from their cars, and then when they get out to live stream through their devices and film through their devices, we can query those videos based on what they were looking at in common. So all the craziness to do with live events and catastrophe, we can hone in on, you know, what's capturing people's attention in real time. That's cool stuff. The U.S. Department of Defense is a client. Strategic Command is a client of ours, and they reached out because of this capability. So I've spent years in R&D and years attracting those strategic clients in this venture to try to be in a position so that the world understands what this algorithm is. And Hewlett-Packard Enterprise really, I think, gets it more than anyone else. And now we have the processing power and the distribution to take these algorithms to, you know, much larger platform.
Yeah, so cool. So, you know, if we go even a little bit more concretely for some of our listeners, you know, here we've got, you know, this algorithm attached to the server. Let's say it's, you know, we get all these uploaded YouTube videos of, you know, police crimes or whatever. The news has been filled with tons of different examples.
Yeah.
How do you see that impacting day-to-day life, this, you know, this upcoming merger? And what do you think is now going to be possible with this?
Well, merger meaning partnership.
Partnership, yes. Yeah. Better way to say it, yeah.
That's a loaded word.
Yeah.
So imagine this. Twitter, that I think is, like most, is a really interesting company, is very noisy, right? You have thousands of tweets that originate from chaotic circumstances. You have 2,000 tweets a second or a minute come out of the Super Bowl. You don't know if it's Justin Bieber getting a lot of attention, who's 1,000 miles away, or you don't know if he's an actual eyewitness to the event. What we can do from a platform perspective is create a data object that where the content that sits on top of this data object can be authenticated as eyewitness. You know that these devices actually witness this. So what it means, I think, from everyday life is through partnerships like HPE, you'll see the creation of a new signal, a new way to cut through the noise of things, something crazy is happening. And from fake news to, you know, to everything else, there's no way to cut through it to say, did this really happen? And we can say it's actually happening here. And all the content that we know that this content viewed it. And let me give you an example on the other side of the spectrum, which is where the Department of Defense and some other guys come in. You remember the terrible Boston bombing?
Yeah.
So this thing happens, you know exactly the location where the bomb went off. So imagine giving us a million images or videos for that matter of including the all this chaos. We can search those things by the location, the focal coordinates of the bomb. You can't search, if someone took a picture of the bomb location from 100 meters away on the top of a rooftop, you can't query that by location, right? Because they're so far away, but you can query the object of interest in the image. And that's how these algorithms can play out as well.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Totally. How, once you've got that information and that data, like in real time, for example, how does that data then get broadcasted? How do people become informed once it's been captured?
Well, that's the challenge of a tiny company and the notion of, you know, what we're trying to do strategically. So I'm able to attract, you know, one enterprise at a time. And we have partnerships with the likes of Sony, where we've done some really interesting things with events for them. But I think these partnerships like HP Enterprise are going to give us the lift to really take this from a platform perspective out broadly, where we've just been able to, you know, sniper with particular enterprises. So first is the reach. I've not been let in the door at Apple. You asked for failure and conflict. Apple won't talk to me. Apple, are you listening? You know, we're not the Apple types for whatever reason. And, you know, that's fine. But imagine getting this on every Apple phone. And what if, you had the context, or Apple had the context of knowing where everyone in the world in real time were aiming their phones in common? Every breaking news event in the world, by definition, has these phones going up. So from a platform perspective, but I haven't been able to convince the folks over there to take a look at it. So as we do more of these broad partnerships, we get our stuff, I think, more firmly integrated from a platform perspective. And unfortunately, that's the one of the risks of a small company. You can have something great, but it's one hand clapping because you're not out there yet.
Totally. So let's future pace for just a moment. There you are, 1 to 2 years from now. We're maybe having a follow-up interview or talking about this. What does that look like in terms of this technology being out there fully expressed in the world 1 to 2 years from now?
Baked into a mobile platform, a phone platform, or there's more success with things like smart glasses, where someone invents a unit of glasses that really can be worn cosmetically. You've got the various major manufacturers of glasses now getting into this from a design perspective, but some unit of hardware and some reach where all our algorithms have to do is sit in the background. And then all of a sudden you have the context of where everyone is looking in common. And location-based services is a $1 billion industry. There's been Foursquare, there's been all these companies that have, you know, monetized these different things. This is focus-based services. It's a whole new thing. We trademarked it, we've patented it. We own the patent on devices doing something like this. Imagine how some of our conversations progress now that people start to get this. It's fantastic too, but it took us years, and I was doing all these demonstrations and waving my arms in the air and installing things all over the place. And sometimes, you know, people just have to pay attention. And that's such an important lesson. Another Edison quote, paraphrasing, he said something to the tune of, most people fail because they didn't realize how close to success they were before they gave up, right? And I use that all the time. I mean, it's such an important thing to keep in mind. Now, it's a built-in rationalization because you can't go forever. And you need metrics, you need quantifiable things to look at that you're doing something. But sometimes things take longer and are very hard.
I love that. Such good advice. John Fisher, everyone. For those that are listening, we've got an awesome giveaway coming up in just a moment after this rapid fire round. Talk about Google Glass. We'll get into that to be continued in a few minutes. But series of random questions. John, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Question number one, fill in the blank. If you really knew me, you would know what?
If you really knew me, you would know how committed I am to family and how committed I am to doing something honorably, even though I have to be so aggressive sometimes in running a company. And that's tough. I think there's a different way to keep score in the Valley. I think there's a new currency. People want to be Elon Musk. I get it. But isn't he divorcing his second wife for the second time? I guess those are some of the sacrifices that it takes to be a genius and to perform like that. I'm not that, but I don't want that either.
Yeah. Next question, piggybacking off this first question, what is one practice that you do daily or try to do daily to keep your wife happy, to keep your family in a harmonious balance?
I try to explain what is concerning me, so it's not just the evangelizing and the arm waving around, and I try to be present, and I think that's so important. Every single day, my wife and daughter today are just traveling, you know, back home, and I have this vision of, you know, how we're going to go for dinner and how we're going to go for a walk, and it's so easy to let these days escape you because you're pursuing these business ventures, and then all of a sudden you have a breakdown or whatever it is. So being present each day, my seven-year-old does not care how much money we have, doesn't care how famous we are. She cares about what we're doing at that moment. And that's not a difficult lesson to learn. This is not, spiritual stuff. This is just listen to people maybe who are a little older. How's that for your folks who are a little older and who have just walked through it, and they all say the same things. They all say, well, the youth is wasted. It's not. Just be younger and listen more.
Next question. What is one book or resource that you believe this audience would really benefit from knowing about?
Our daughter's middle name is Emerson, named after the great poet and writer. I think Self-Reliance has some really interesting things in it. It's just a good read, and it's beautifully written, and I think it applies to a lot of what we're talking about
here. Yeah, awesome. Next question, favorite way to exercise or move your body?
So this is something I learned as I'm getting a little older here. So I walk at a 9, 10, 12, 15% incline indefinitely. I mean, I answer my emails on this thing, or I'll watch a movie, and you'll burn, 1300 calories doing this stuff versus, things where you're immobilized. I love the walking at an incline. And the beauty, remember, let's be strategic about what we're doing. When you go in for your stress test, that's the test they give you. So you're like superhuman. It's like, how are you doing so well? Well, the exercise that you're using to test me is the one I do every day.
So good. The inventor coming out.
Naming the system.
I love that. All right. Last question. What does living an unconventional life mean to you?
It means a balance. A lot of people at my daughter's school think I am a stay-at-home dad, which I love because I am able to spend so much time there. And, stay-at-home, don't stay-at-home, build this, do that. That none of it matters. But if you're able to do something you love and balance it with your family and not hurt anyone along the way, Emerson wrote to that too, that is to have succeeded.
So good. All right, John, tell us about this giveaway. Super generous, amazing, epic giveaway that you've got for one of us.
Yeah, I mean, if you're forced to deal with me for the whole term, you gotta be rewarded here. So how about we give away a unit of Google Glass, right? They don't even sell these things anymore. And why don't we get those to one of your listeners, and maybe they can even help us do some designing or just do some walking around. But these things are great devices. We're actually using them less frequently in our builds. We've built some other things, and I think Google has had some problems that have been announced, but it's still a fantastic device, huge invention, love spending time with the people over there that invented it. And we'd like to one of your folks to have one. and then see where it takes us.
Yeah, so good. So guys that are listening, unconventionallifeshow.com, head over there right now. We'll have all the details about the Google Glass. And John, for those that want to learn more about CrowdOptic, want to stay in touch with you, want to keep this conversation going, how should they do that?
You know, I'll always give out my email address and always trade ideas with anyone. I love talking about it. It's Fisher John B, no C in the Fisher, no H in the John, B as in boy, at crowdoptic.com. And, you know, maybe I'll you'll have an idea that that I can use. I mean, it's a two-way thing. There's always such a condescending air to, you know, email me and I'll try to help you. No way. Help me too. If you're listening to this and you have some great ideas.
Amazing. Awesome. John Fisher, thank you so much for tuning in with us, sharing all this amazing knowledge and Unconventional Life family. So much love to you guys as well. Guys, this is the end of our episode. We'll have some more coming at you shortly. John, thanks again.
Thank you.